That's the great John Coltrane on tenor sax, taking the lead on Blue Train, the title track on the album released in 1957. I do like the oldies. His sidemen on this gold album include Lee Morgan on trumpet, Curtis Fuller on trombone, Kenny Drew, piano, Paul Chambers on bass, and Philly Joe Jones on drums. An incredible group all together. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Monday, November the 17th, and 101 days since the shooting death of Michael Brown by Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson, and communities and cities across the nation tensely await the grand jury's decision on whether Wilson will face charges. Indictment or no, Darren Wilson gets a valuable Thanksgiving gift from the grand jury. That gift is immunity. If there's no indictment, Wilson immediately will return to active duty, says Police Chief Tom Jackson. If the grand jury does indict, he adds, the officer, quote, most likely, unquote, will be terminated, quote, if it is a felony. Very interesting. Under immunity deals typically agreed to by prosecutors, Wilson's 4 hours before the grand jury, touted by prosecutor Robert McCullough as an earnest desire to lay bare all of the facts of the fatal encounter with Brown, possibly have shielded the officer from prosecution, not only in the current case, but in future cases as well, in which his testimony could substantiate new charges. Our guest today is the best person for this job that we're about to embark upon. Starting today, we will be concentrating on this case this week and on the legal aspects of this case because, you know, a lot is going to be going on outside, but the legal deconstruction is really necessary. And for that, there's only one person that I could think of, and that's attorney at war, Alton Maddox Jr. He has litigated and won some of the most contentious criminal and civil rights cases in New York City in recent years. And he is here with us today as our very esteemed guest and guide. He explains why a key element in the grand jury's decision is the immunity deal that McCullough might have given Wilson in exchange for Wilson's testimony. And with that, Alton, I thank you for being with us and welcome to Lead Stories.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Eutrice.
Well, let's start with this notion of what happens when, what might have happened, because this is going to be a typical scenario here where, because you have prosecuted these cases, you've litigated many of these cases before, and the issue of immunity is a critical one to understand because it actually is at the base of the grand jury's decision. Could you explain how this concept of immunity works?
Well, one, there are two types of immunity. One is transactional immunity, which is used here in New York, and is the one that is rarely on the books in most states because they use what is called use immunity. And in use immunity, the issue comes down to whether the testimony offered by the witness can be used in subsequent matters. And I believe this is the issue here in Ferguson, is that, if you offer Wilson use immunity, you're basically saying that we really don't have to use your testimony in other cases. and it also gives the witness an opportunity to promote public relations before the grand jury. So in a real sense, the witness is not exposed to any risk as a result of the testimony that he may give, because use immunity would prevent that testimony to be employed. And then given the fact that it is very difficult, in my opinion, and I've written on this on many occasions, I just wrote some stuff recently about this, it's very difficult for blacks to enter in the legal process and to be taken credible. And I think I've said this on so many other occasions that I've never used witnesses in my defense of a defendant, because I found that that was a quick guarantee for going to the big house, and I tried to avoid that. So in my practice, even though I've tried hundreds of cases, I only use witness testimony twice, and in both of those cases, the results were not good. But you know, I had to take a shot at it in one of the cases because it was really the only way that the client could have gotten out of it anyway, because of the affirmative defense that New York employed with respect to matters which you are charged with acting in concert, and therefore the party has to prove to the jury that, A, I had no idea what my confederates were about to do, and B, if I did, I still didn't know that one of the confederates had a gun. And so, you know, that's a high step. But we didn't even get there because what happens too often when the prosecutor gets an opportunity to go after a black person, it usually ends up like, you know, say in the Trayvon Martin case where the young lady got up and tried to describe what had really occurred while she was on the phone, as Zimmerman was gearing up to eliminate or exterminate Trayvon Martin. And so then she became an issue herself. So what has happened here is that the prosecutor realized that when we bring these other witnesses before the grand jury, then testimony is not going to be well received, and therefore the grand jury is going to react in favor of Wilson instead of against him. And, you know, this is the reason why I feel for so many different factors involved in the Michael Brown shooting, that it is highly unlikely that Wilson would be indicted.
Well, we came to that conclusion on August the 20th. Actually, we did that program saying all the reasons why this case already had gone down the wrong track. But let's return to this business of transactional immunity, which is usually just total and blanket immunity from prosecution. Mm-hmm. It is unlikely, you think, that that kind of immunity was given to Wilson?
No, I don't. I know transactional immunity would not be given to him because it is something that even the prosecutors here in New York, you know, seem to argue against the use of transactional immunity. But my point is that you don't really have to go there. You know, use immunity within the context of a case in which the incriminating witness or the witnesses that are going to offer incriminating testimony against Wilson are primarily persons of African ancestry, and therefore that testimony is not going to be greeted kindly in the first place. And so by offering use immunity to Wilson, you know, you're not hurting him, and the benefits of use immunity outweighs the cost, and so therefore, you know, I'm pretty sure that the prosecutor is not really having a serious problem offering use immunity to him.
Now, in the granting of use immunity, even if there is no, even if there is an indictment, this use immunity that he would have obtained during this grand jury's tenure would give him certain protections or shield him in future cases. For example, the federal government is doing its own, the Justice Department is doing its own investigation. Should the investigation result, let's say, in a criminal action, the use immunity that would have been extended to Wilson in the current grand jury would protect him how in any other future prosecution?
Well, the federal prosecution, if it ever occurred, would be such that the federal government would give a great deference to the context in which Wilson testified in a state grand jury. And so my point is that he would not have to worry, even if there was a federal prosecution, of his testimony being used to incriminate him.
So we have, in a grand jury proceeding, we have no judge. This is just a prosecutor the jurors.
Right. Well, see, that's where it really gets confusing, because actually there is a judge. It's just that they don't ever get publicized. And that's the wild card in grand jury proceedings is the fact that the judge, you know, supervises over the entire process and therefore has influence on the way that the grand jury is going, because the prosecutor is not just acting alone. There is a judge there to assist and shaping the way that the grand jury proceeding is going. And this is what happened in Tawana Brawley. There was a judge there, and this judge actually influenced the way that things happened, and really had a real conflict in terms of the way the outcome came about. But I think that, you know, the wild card is the fact that these judges don't get publicized, you know, and so.
But the process is very much in the hands of the prosecutor, though. The prosecutor is the one who dominates this whole thing.
Well,
it's a decidedly one-sided affair.
Well, it is, with no question about it. But my point is mm-hmm. that usually judges have a vested interest in promoting white supremacy in the same way that prosecutors have that interest. And so they're not at odds with each other. You know, they're really on the same team. It's just that the judge, there's an opportunity, and if you look at, I'm sure, the Missouri statutes, as you clearly can look at in terms of Article 190 of the criminal procedure law here in New York, you would definitely find that there is some definite input by judges in the process, although, you know, it may be silent, it may seem not to have any overt effect, but the reality of it is that the judge does provide backup for the prosecution.
Wilson's 4 hours of testimony, what does that suggest to you? According to the prosecutor, this was a matter of laying out all of the facts. But as we had discussed earlier, he would not have come before the grand jury and testified for 4 hours if he weren't assured that he was on safe ground.
Well, that's correct, because, you know, the reality of it is prosecutors can pick and choose not only the witnesses that they want to go before a grand jury, but they can also pick and choose the testimony that they want elicited from the witness. And, you know, the bottom line is you don't go into a grand jury and offer a narrative. You go into a grand jury and address a question and answer process. And so that's quite different. I mean, you know, so when somebody go into a grand jury, they're not just going to spill everything that they know, because the process doesn't work that way. It still has to be a Q&A session. And so the prosecutor then is able to decide what questions that he wants to ask the witness, and he also is able to understand how he must be able to give latitude in dealing with the rehabilitation of that witness. And so, you know, it's a one stage process.
But when the prosecutor carefully selects the witness, and the prosecutor is in charge of also guiding the witness's testimony, and if we understand the relationship between the fact that whatever testimony that the witness, in this case Wilson, gives, he also is deriving use immunity from that testimony. So could it be said, I'm trying to see if I could make this connection here, could it be said that a skilled prosecutor could in fact produce the circumstances of a witness giving testimony, a witness who is going to be granted use immunity for the testimony given, that would elicit the specific type of testimony from that witness that will then serve that witness in the event of future prosecutions where the testimony given under use immunity, carefully elicited by the prosecutor, basically sets him up for a protection in future prosecutions?
Well, you know, I think, first of all, what we need to do is to realize that prosecutors have a dry run with respect to a witness, which means that, you have an opportunity outside of the grand jury room to ask certain types of questions. And you also, as a result of that, have the opportunity to impeach the witness if the witness surprises you in the grand jury. And so, you know, you have the weapon of being able to go back and ask the witness that on a prior occasion, then you say A, B, and C, and now you're saying D, E, and F. So that cannot be ignored in the powers that, you know, prosecutors have. And that's the reason why prosecutors do not like to involve themselves in situations where they have a witness and they don't know the answer. And, you know, I have been not only a person who have defended persons going before the grand jury, but I have also been a potential grand jury witness myself in cases in which the prosecutor wanted to indict me and asked me to come before them. And, you know, you go in this little room and you start talking and they ask questions. And, you know, you can either shut up and answer no questions or you can spill your guts. Now, if you happen to spill your guts, that gives them fertile ground in terms of taking you before the grand jury and possibly selecting the testimony that they want the grand jury to hear, knowing full well that, you know, you are smart enough at least not to impeach yourself or not allow yourself to be impeached. So these are situations where, you know, it really depends upon the witness. Now, most people think that you really have to answer questions once you get the subpoena, and they believe that you have to answer any questions in or outside the grand jury room. And because they don't understand that process, those are the people that really get caught up in being abused by a prosecutor. As I said before, when I've had to go before the grand jury, I simply said, hey, you know, I'm not saying nothing until you put me before the grand jury itself. And so, you know, in those kind of situations, you're not in the same predicament as somebody who starts spilling their guts before they even get into the grand jury room.
This case did not go to a preliminary hearing. It went directly to a grand jury. Is there something specifically significant about that?
Well, it definitely is, and you know, I mean, this is something that again, this comes out of my own experiences. You know, in Howard Beach, for example, the prosecutor rarely offers a preliminary hearing here in New York, but in that particular case, they want a preliminary hearing to happen. And you know, if you don't know anything about litigation, you ought to at least know that if the prosecutor wants A, then you should want Z. You know, so in other words, you're diametrically opposed to whatever comes down the pike. You know, so in no wiggle room, you just know, hey, I'm in a straitjacket. If you want A, I want Z. And so, you know, in that particular case, they had scheduled a preliminary hearing, and Cedric Sanford was going to be the guinea pig. And so we got to the preliminary hearing. You know, I stood up and said, well, we're not having a preliminary hearing if, in fact, you need the testimony of Cedric Sanford, because Cedric Sanford is not testifying. And so, you know, that put things in a real downward spiral. You know, as a result of that, ultimately, the state had to decide whether they wanted to meet my demand of a special prosecutor. They wanted to go forward and look embarrassed, and they ultimately had to meet the demand of a special prosecutor. And as a result of meeting that demand, some of those members of the mob that caused the death of Michael Griffith went to jail.
But in observing the conduct of this grand jury, it would seem as if the prosecutor here has used the grand jury in a kind of a hybrid fashion. It's part preliminary hearing, part grand jury proceeding, and part trial. What, from observing this scenario, what do you make of the conduct of this grand jury under the prosecutor here?
Well, I think, you know, you're touching on something that people think about it. You know, it's absolutely true. I think you have to first realize that Chief Judge Saul Wattler here in New York, head of the Court of Appeals at the time, said that you could indict a ham sandwich. Now, most people just heard that and didn't really examine that. But what he was saying was, is that once you establish probable cause, you should be able to indict a ham sandwich. Now, the problem comes when you have established probable cause outside of the grand jury, and now you're going before the grand jury not to indict a ham sandwich, meaning probable cause, but you're going before the grand jury now to ask them to review probable cause and come up with a different decision as to what probable cause means in this particular case. Now, that's exactly what happened in Ferguson. The prosecutor had probable cause, you know, because you got to understand, there's no way in the world that Darrell Wilson can argue at this stage, anyway, there's no way he can argue that his life was in jeopardy. Now, when he comes to trial, he can offer that as a trial defense, and then maybe a petty jury may go along with him. But right now, it's a one-sided effort, and the one-sided effort is that you shot somebody who was unarmed. And, you know, and therefore you need to go to trial to see whether, in fact, you know, you can establish a self-defense as a means of getting out of this, or otherwise you should be convicted. Now, what the prosecutor has done is to ignore what the evidence showed outside of the grand jury, and is now back into a grand jury process where you don't know what he's doing now, and what he's really doing is unraveling what happened on the night that Michael Brown was killed, and is using this process to sanitize all of the probable cause that had once existed in the case.
Well, this is the question. I'm just observing it, and I'm saying, well, I'm not so sure what kind of jury, grand jury this is, because it seems as if he was conducting a trial, a one-sided trial, because certainly there was no view from the other side, even.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. He was conducting a trial, but he was also conducting an appeal of that probable cause, and to argue that a probable cause never existed. And so, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, I have no problem with your hypothesis, because it is absolutely correct. And this is what he has abused the grand jury process to come up with a wrong result. I mean, this is exactly what has happened here. And he's been given the opportunity to do it in a closet where nobody can put in the sunshine on it.
Well, this again, we're still talking the legal piece here. When this grand jury was impaneled, was there any leverage that anybody had to say, we want to monitor this from the inside, not from the outside? We don't just want to get the word at the end of 3 months of testimony, but we want to be able to monitor what is going on in this grand jury. Was there any room for leverage by independent parties, for example, the lawyers representing the family, to have an inside view of what was going on here, or leverage to demand that this be an open process?
Well, you know, the answer to that is, to any lawyer, the answer is yes and no. And the reason why it is yes, because there is some wiggle room. The reason why the answer is no is because if you exercise that wiggle room, you will end up in the same predicament as Alton Maddox, because that's what happened with Tawana Brawley. You know, people don't realize this, and so, you know, everybody just take off with what the master said, because we're dealing with master-slave law here, and we're dealing with a people who conditioned to believe the master. But the reality of it was, is that in that grand jury process, we had met with Abrams before the grand jury process started. And
now,
so,
this is Robert Abrams, the state attorney general in New York.
Right, New York state attorney general. And what we had gotten out of that was something that had never happened before. And this is why sometimes, you know, our people got to learn to write their history so that, you know, they can always go back to it. Because there is something that has happened in the past in some situations that you ought to be able to go back to. But when you don't write your own history, and we are notorious for not writing our history and let somebody else write it for us, so it get ignored. But the reality of it is, this was the first time in the history of New York that a grand jury was picked publicly. That means that even though the grand jury process later went into secrecy, but at the time when the grand jury was picked, it was not done in secret. And this is the first time that ever happened in New York at all. And so, you know, right from the beginning, we had some idea of how this process would work. So, yes, the answer is yes and no. There is some leverage. The problem is how many lawyers, you know, are going to exist like an automatic who's going to come up with some creative approaches to deal with these problems.
So whether the grand jury indicts or doesn't indict, it is safe to say that by virtue of appearing, just by virtue of appearing before the grand jury and basically going with the flow of the questioning and the conduct of this grand jury by the prosecutor, basically in charge of everything, enjoying immunity, use immunity, no matter how it works out, whether the grand jury says, yes, we are indicting, or we see no reason to indict, Officer Darren Wilson, at the end of the day, can at least say, I have some kind of protection in case of something else coming up in which charges are going to be levied against me.
Well, you know, again, let me also point out some history here, because this is another part of history here in New York that most of us don't recall because we don't write down our history in the first place. But in the Michael Stewart case, where a young man was viciously beaten by 11 transit cops and was sent into a coma, which he never came out of, there was a first grand jury presentation in which Robert Morgenthau was able to get a grand jury to return a no true bill. Now, generally, you know, to most people, once there's the filing of a no true bill, everybody pack up their bags and go home. Now, in this particular case, I had been called in to assist Lewis Clayton Jones and Michael Warren in terms of dealing with the grand jury, and we turned around and forced New York to reverse its earlier decision not to indict and to now indict the 11 transit cops, and they had to go to trial and face a jury. Now, that's another piece of history that people don't understand, but that happened. And so, you know, unfortunately for me, you know, I had to first be prosecuted myself in a case called People versus Maddox, in which they were trying to send me to prison as well as to disbar me because the conviction would have been an automatic disbarment. But they failed. You know, and I had a chance to live another day, so to speak. But the point is that even if this grand jury does not indict, there should still be another call for another state investigation, this time hopefully with a special prosecutor. And hopefully with a different result, where Darren Wilson will at least have to face a jury of his peers in St. Louis County.
When Darren Wilson came before this grand jury, are you satisfied that the grand jury was going to be conducted by a fair-minded person, an uncompromised person, meaning the prosecutor, that the prosecutor was unhindered and therefore completely unbiased in this situation?
No, well, we know it absolutely wasn't. And, you know, one of the things that happened here is the fact that just based upon some limited knowledge, I understood that seemingly was not exploited. You know, what has to happen in these kinds of cases is that you have to actually do some detective work of your own to really make it clearly understood that the prosecutor in this circumstance could in no way be fair. And I don't know whether that really was done, but that's something that has to be done by lawyers. And so you can't really put that on the community to do. And then, but the community has to turn around and support the lawyers who are doing that. And that's another problem comes about because when, you know, when something happens and it's not favorable to the lawyers, the community runs for the tall grass instead of putting their arms around that lawyer or lawyers and saying, we got your back. And that's just some, that's some terminology that we have not learned yet. And so, you know, we ended up putting our back to the wind and running for the tall grass. But it's no question about it, that, in this particular case, this should be viewed as a protracted struggle. And some of the things, some of the chips that were not used, this go around should be used in another go around, to make sure that at some point this man has to face a trial jury, possibly of 12 members of his community.
What concerns you about the prosecutor?
Well, I think the thing about it is that from what I understand, you know, there are things in his own background, you know, that would suggest to anyone that you can't be fair. Now, that's something in addition to what I know to be a fact. The reason why prosecutors should not be prosecuting police cases is because there's an inherent conflict of interest in those cases because the prosecutor has to turn right around and run for political office again. And in running for political office again, the prosecutor now has to face a well-organized police department, or I more interestingly would call it a standing army. And so, you know, when you're dealing with that, that's something that you don't necessarily need because if something happens to Darrell Wilson, you can bet your bottom dollar that the police department is not going to take it lying down. And so, you know, the fact that in this particular case, I believe that this prosecutor, you know, has some skeletons in his in his background, you know, in terms of his own father being killed by a black man, et cetera, et cetera. I think that, you know, that on top of the fact that he is an elected official in the first place, having to go before the electorate in order to get reelected, I think it's just a little bit too much for any of us to ask in terms of this prosecutor being fair.
If you were the attorney for the family, what concerns would you have as this case developed, and what tact would you have taken as the family's attorney?
Well, I think I think when you're practicing law, you can't be concerned about the opinions of people around you. The only thing you can be concerned about is your client. In this particular case, it is the estate of Michael Brown that you have to be concerned about. And you have to be concerned about getting justice, first of all, for Michael Brown before you can start thinking about hush money or some other things that may be offered to you. Now, you know, with me, I believe I had been in St. Louis County, there would have been no question that there would have been an indictment in this case. I mean, I can't see how it couldn't have been an indictment in this case. But, you know, you have to take some extraordinary measures in order to bring that about. And the question becomes whether you're prepared to take those extraordinary measures or not. And I haven't seen that from Michael Brown's attorneys or anyone, you know, that will have some relationship to the process. And so, you know, it is a tough obligation to have to be able to satisfy. But I think it could have been satisfied. It may have ended up, though, you know, you've been standing like me, penniless and homeless, But I think you could certainly say that you could have gotten an indictment out of this case.
What would some of those extraordinary measures that you mentioned, what would those have been?
Well, first of all, I would have done an extremely extensive investigation in terms of this prosecutor's background. You know, because that's where it, you know, I mean, that's where it really comes out. And people who are really afraid of doing that, you know, not going to really examine this man very closely. And so, you know, you're dealing with a situation where, you know, you want to be able to do that. The other thing that you have to do, you have to be aggressive in terms of motion practice. You have to be aggressive in terms of how do you use the writ of mandamus to compel a prosecutor to do something that on the books is his responsibility to do. So it's a combination of things that you have to be very aggressive in doing. And what I have seen, I have not seen that, and I have seen people being laid back. And I can say this because anybody that know my history know that, you know, the approach that I would have taken in this case has already been spelled out. So it's not like I'm sitting here boasting now. You know, there's a record that shows you what has to happen. My problem has been I just haven't been able to get the support of the community because I was just ahead of my own people. But in terms of getting an indictment, I can certainly tell you that could have happened. The problem would have been what happens after the indictment when your own people run for the tall grass and leave you standing.
Should there be an indictment?
Oh, no question about it, because the indictment has already been spelled out by what we know before we even got to the district attorney. We know that, for example, the lead Supreme Court case in this area is a case called Garner versus Tennessee. And in Garner versus Tennessee, which I haven't heard anybody mention here in Ferguson, the Supreme Court held that you cannot shoot a fleeing felon. Now, if you juxtapose that to Michael Brown, he wasn't fleeing at all. And so, you know, the answer becomes very clear. You cannot shoot Michael Brown under the situation in which he found himself in. And that has been already promulgated by the Supreme Court in the case of Garner versus Tennessee.
Let's say that the grand jury comes back with an indictment. What do you think happens then?
Well, I think what happens then is that the McCullough's fate is sealed, so I think he should start looking for another job. And I think that the governor of the state is going to start doing a moonwalk so that he won't really suffer too much as a result of this. But then, you know, it goes through the other stages of the process. It goes through pretrial motions, the question of whether there's sufficient evidence in the first place to have indicted. And then it goes through if the judge decide that there was sufficient evidence to indict. Then it goes through the question of how do you find a jury in Ferguson, St. Louis County, that would be fair on both sides of the equation. And so now you're dealing with a situation from the state's point of view, how do you stack a jury, which also becomes another question. And very seldom do you see lawyers challenging the composition of the jury or the makeup of the jury or the process in which the jury was assembled in the first place. So those are some of the key points that would certainly have to be litigated. And then, of course, after that, you know, there are always going to be other issues, such as how can we keep this piece of evidence out, how can we keep that piece of evidence out. So, you know, it's a very involved process. Even if you do get an indictment, there's still a lot of work to be done.
We still have to figure out what the charges actually are that are being contemplated.
Right, absolutely. And you have to figure out what the indictment really reads, you know, which is absolutely true. But as I said before, That issue comes up when the lawyers file a motion to dismiss the indictment. Then they go through the grand jury record and see what is there to support any particular charges that the grand jury returned in this particular case.
At the point that the prosecutor convened this grand jury and began this process, and it, of course, has lasted for 3 months, and it is a combination, as I've said, of preliminary hearing, grand jury proceeding, basic regular trial, and even departmental hearing to find out whether the police officer was acting within departmental guidelines. It's a kind of a very strange grand jury, and the copious amounts of evidence. Was there a time when this process had just begun, was there a time that something could have been done to halt it and to question it and to compel the prosecutor to actually define exactly what this process was going to be?
Well, you know, and that goes through motion practice. I mean, that's what we're saying. We didn't see hardly any of that. I mean, I don't live in Ferguson, Missouri, but, you know, just where I stood and watched, I didn't see the kind of motion practice that is necessary to put the prosecution on guard as to what people should be watching through this entire process. Because when you don't file motions, you don't really cue the community up as to what they should really be watching. So it's an educational process as well. And so, you know, I didn't see that, the education from attorneys. I just saw some attorneys taking advantage of the microphone for their own personal advantage.
Is there still any wiggle room here to, for lack of a better term, to take control of this case at this point, or is it completely out of the hands of lawyers and especially the lawyers for the family? To do anything about? Could they have any possible influence on anything?
Well, yeah. Well, see, this is what bothers me. Benjamin Crump, who is apparently the lead family attorney in this case, has now been elected as the president-elect of the National Bar Association. And the question that would arise is where has the National Bar Association been all of this time when, you know, you've been dealing with this situation? Especially, I mean, even though this is not necessarily a critical factor, but the National Bar Association was formed in a neighboring state, the state of Iowa, in the first place. And so, you know, the whole concern about blacks having a national bar, you know, came out of a neighboring state, the state of Iowa. And the question becomes, you know, you haven't heard anything about amicus curiae briefs. You haven't heard anything about motions to entertain, motion to intervene. You have not heard about any filings of writs of mandamus. I mean, so there's a number of things that have absolutely been missing in this particular case, and you can't expect people to go to the streets and do all of this without any kind of legal backup. I mean, that's impossible. People don't realize, you know, just like you try to tell people in New York. I mean, you cannot expect somebody just to march and you'll bring justice just hollering, "No justice, no peace." I mean, it has to be more than that to the process. And it is more than that to the process. And, you know, when I came to New York 40 years ago, New York did not have a real civil CIVIL rights, RIGHTS movement. And, you know, in order to really jumpstart that, I had to give up a whole practice of law. I didn't continue as a lawyer because it was impossible for me to come into a state in which they were still practicing segregation in the courtrooms. I mean, you know, and so what could I do? You know, when you got blacks being roped off in different areas of the courtroom, and now, you know, I came back just this week or 2 weeks ago, Black Solidarity Day, and found out they were still doing that. You know, right here in New York, this is 2014, and they're still roping off courtrooms and telling blacks to go in one area and whites to go in another. I ran into this in Manhattan, not Staten Island. I ran into this in Manhattan 40 years ago. So that shows you how far things have gotten. And so, you know, I decided then the only way that blacks in New York had any semblance of getting justice was for me to forego a private practice and instead become what I call a private attorney general.
Well, Private Attorney General, I want to thank you for being with us today and for getting us kind of oriented on the legal questions, whether or when this decision comes in. People will have a different point of reference now in understanding what is at play here and where this case needs to go. And, of course, we will come back tomorrow and we will deal with the same continuing subject, the legal aspects of this case. And, of course, it will have to do with the decision, which will we are assuming will be any day now, it's been said, any day now we should hear this great decision. But Alton, I want to thank you again for being with us today and for being so generous with your time and your knowledge and your expertise. And, of course, we'll see you tomorrow.
You sure you may add one thing?
Sure.
Real quick, because I have done this in preparation of people getting ready for what may happen in Ferguson. And I start off with the proposition that white supremacists are bilingual. They only speak two languages. One is legalese and the other one is violence. Those are their two languages, so it has to deal with that. I would suggest that everybody between here and tomorrow go to my website, www.reinstatealtonmaddox.com, because I have begun to develop some real background work behind what is going on in Ferguson.
All right. Thank you so much again, Alton. We'll see you tomorrow.
Thank you, Trace.
Thanks. And that brings us to the end of the program today. I hope something has registered with you that, you know, behind what the news announcements will say whenever this decision comes, we need to have an appreciation for what the law is and how it works and how it is applied in order to achieve predetermined results. Stay tuned. Coming up next, The Infectious Myth with David Crow. Reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, and stories, plural, at gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. As always, a pleasure and a very great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.